Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi. Before we get started on this new season of Guilt, I just want to say a few words. If you're new to this podcast, welcome. I'm Ryan Wolfe. In 2013, I graduated with a degree in law from Waikato University in New Zealand, and in 2014, I passed the bar. In 2021, I started this podcast with the goal of using my legal background to investigate unsolved cold cases in New Zealand and Australia. And Guilt has become one of Australasia's most popular true crime podcasts, with millions of downloads and winning multiple awards. But more importantly, it's been able to shine a light on cases that need it. For some of you, the style of this podcast will be unlike others you've heard. In this podcast, you're going to come along with me during a live investigation. We'll be chasing leads, dead ends, and going down rabbit holes, staking out properties, and uncovering fresh evidence. It's no holds barred, and I must warn you that this podcast features mature content, including discussion of murder, sex, rape, and drug use. It's raw and real, because that's what life is. And when we pursue the truth, we need to be honest and upfront. Throughout this podcast, you'll meet many people and hear many names. Unless otherwise stated, these are all real people, and everyone should always be presumed innocent of any crime unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Unless otherwise stated, police statements and other official documents will be read by actors. This is a free podcast, available on all good podcast platforms. However, those who wish to get episodes 1 week early, plus have ad-free listening and exclusive bonus episodes, you have the option to become a paid Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find all the details of how to subscribe by visiting our website, theguiltpodcast.com. You'll also find the link to Acast Plus in the description of every episode. For the price of a coffee each month, those who choose to become subscribers are genuinely supporting these investigations, and I thank you. Aside from the weekly release of podcast episodes, you can stay informed on the case by subscribing to our free email newsletter at theguiltpodcast.com. I'm not a big user of Facebook, but I do regularly share posts and daily stories on my Instagram page, RyanWolfNZ. And please, if you're a local resident of Melton or Melbourne, please spread the word of this podcast and Alana's case. Due to the length of time since Alana's death, many of the people involved have proved difficult to find, and your help is crucial. Finally, this series has no set end date. This is a real-life investigation, and it will continue until we reach a conclusion, whatever that might be. At times, this case is going to shock, sadden, and sicken you. And I hope it does, because it's through you, as collective listeners, that we have the power to pursue the truth. And finally, justice for Alana. If you have any information related to the death of Alana Cecil, please contact us either by email at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com or via our website, theguiltpodcast.com. It's November 9th, 1996. A group of teenagers make their way on foot through the streets of the small city of Melton, just outside of Melbourne in Victoria, Australia. It's a beautiful blue sky day, and thousands of locals are attending the biggest event of the year, the Jerriwa Bonfire Festival. A day-long event featuring a street parade, live music, and finally, a ceremonial bonfire. Billed as a family event, throughout the day, children enjoy the carnival rides and food stalls. But for local teenagers, the real fun begins when the sun sets. And for this group of friends, it's no different. As they approach the venue, they finish their drinks and stash what they can in the nearby bushes before entering the event. At this moment, an on-duty police officer drives past this group and sighs. It's going to be a long night. For local Melton police, the Jerriwa Festival is always a busy night on the calendar, as some take celebrations well into the night. In the early hours of Sunday, the 10th of November, a local sergeant drives the streets. It's actually been a good night, quieter than most years. However, as he drives along Station Road, he notices a man on the street trying to get his attention. The man waves him down, and in that moment, points out a person slumped in the carport of a vacant house. It's the body of a young girl, whose death would crush a family and shock a community, and still remains a mystery 28 years later.
My name is Boyer Dennis Wayne. I'm making this statement at 8 a.m. on the 18th of December 1996 at Melton Police Station. On Sunday the 10th of November 1996, I was on duty at Melton Police Station when at approximately 8 a.m. I commenced patrol duties, travelling south along Station Road, Melton, approaching the intersection with Barry's Road. As I approached the intersection, my attention was drawn to the driveway of 211 Station Road by a male person walking along the street, who indicated to me by pointing that there was a person in the driveway of 211 Station Road, half seated on the driveway under the carport at the address and leaning against the side of the house. The male pedestrian kept on walking. I then drove into the driveway of 211 Station Road, Melton, and could clearly see the form of a female person propped in a seating position on the driveway of the house, leaning against the sidewall of the house nearby to a brick chimney. I could see that this person appeared to be female by way of dress, dressed in black slacks, a black jacket, and lady's shoes. Her head was to the side with her hair across the majority of her face. It appeared on first glance that she was asleep. I then approached and gently tapped the bottom of her foot to arouse her, and on doing so I immediately realised that the female was deceased. A further check for vital signs confirmed this, as the body was very cold and colourless. From first observations, she appeared to be approximately 18 years of age. Due to the fact of the position and age of the deceased, and the knowledge that 211 Station Road, Melton was a vacant house under renovation, I did not disturb anything further. I immediately requested the attendance of Melton CIB. I was unable to identify the female at this stage because her hair was covering the majority of her face. A short time after this, Senior Detective Hythorn of the Melton CIB took charge of the scene and I departed. At approximately 11:10 a.m. on that day, at the request of Senior Detective Hythorn, I returned to the scene at 211 Station Road, Melton. As a result of a conversation with Hythorn, I then went to the body of the deceased and moved the hair away from her face. I immediately recognised the deceased as being Alana Cecil, aged 16 years, of Melton South, who I've known for a number of years. However, I'd not seen Alana in the past 12 months. As a result of this and a further conversation with Hythorn and a member of the homicide squad, I then attended an address in Melton South where I notified the parents of her death. When I first sighted the body of the deceased, I was of the opinion that this was not a normal seating position for a person who had just sat for a rest or sleep. It appeared that she had been placed in an upright position and then the head had rolled to the left side of the shoulder. From the time I sighted the body and until Senior Detective Hythorn took charge of the scene, the body was not altered in any way. I hereby acknowledge that this statement is true and correct, and I make it in the belief that a person making a false statement in these circumstances is liable to the penalties of perjury.
I, Michael Burke, am a legally qualified medical practitioner and senior pathologist at the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine and Fellow of the Royal College of Pathologists of Australasia. On the 11th day of November 1996, I was contacted by the coroner's office of a scene of death at 211 Station Road, Melton. I attended the scene in the company of Dr. Malcolm Dodd, Forensic Pathology Registrar. A young Caucasian female was sitting in the carport of an unoccupied house with her back against the wall of the house. Examination showed no evidence of significant injury. Needle marks were found within the right cubital fossa. Death was certified at 11 a.m. on the 10th November 1996. I organised for a post-mortem examination to be performed the following morning. During the external examination, I could see that the body was that of a young Caucasian female, measuring approximately 162 centimetres and weighing 53 kilograms. She was wearing a black lace-up type cardigan. The garment was tied with a bow secured at the upper part of the garment. No evidence of damage to the garment was seen. Blue-coloured jeans. The top two buttons fastened and lower two buttons not fastened off the fly. The underpants were inside out and back to front. Black slip-on style shoes. Within the left back pocket of the jeans was a plastic bank-type card in situ, which was removed at the scene. A large amount of dirt was present over the bottom aspect of the jeans. A lesser amount of dirt and other material was present over the back of the jean legs. The deceased had shoulder-length brown-coloured hair. Eyes brown in colour. No petechial hemorrhages or trauma. Mascara was worn. Nose intact. Mouth, natural definition, no trauma. Ears, right ear pierced with two gold-coloured rings in situ. The left ear had a gold-coloured ring in situ and one gold and one silver stud. Neck, normal. Worn around the neck were three black leather and material necklaces with a gold crucifix and gold-coloured stone in situ. Chest and abdomen, no evidence of injury. An orange-coloured elastic material-type bracelet was worn on the right wrist. Right cubital fossa, fresh puncture injury. Anterior aspect of right wrist and forearm, multiple transverse healed scars. Left cubital fossa, fresh puncture wound. Left forearm, lateral aspect, a group of three transverse old scars measuring up to 1.2 centimetres. Dorsal aspect of left forearm, left wrist, an amateur tattoo of the words Don Scott, measuring 6 by 4 centimetres. Lower limbs, no evidence of any injury. Posterior aspect of right upper buttock, a tattoo of a blue rose, measuring 3 by 1.5 centimetres. The stomach contains a moderate volume of brown-coloured fluid. No granular material or formed tablets are seen. Neck musculature showed no evidence of bruising. Upper limbs showed a bruise over the dorsal aspect of the left hand, measuring 6 by 5 centimetres. No abraded injury was seen to the knuckle. subcutaneous dissection of the cubital fossae confirmed recent puncture sites. Samples of tissue from selected organ sites taken for histology included specimens for toxicology and radiology. Swabs and sample taken for forensic science. Results of histology show an acute bruise on the left cubital fossa. Toxicology examination showed a morphine concentration in blood of 0.3 milligrams per litre. Morphine was found within urine, indicating the use of heroin. Microscopic examination showed changes in keeping with acute asthma. Post-mortem examination showed no evidence of any significant injury that could have led to death. I determined the cause of death to be heroin toxicity in a young female with acute asthma. I hereby acknowledge that this statement is true and correct, and I make it in the belief that a person making a false statement in the circumstances is liable to the penalties of perjury.
The family of a Melton teenager who died 6 years ago are for the first time appealing for further information about the girl's death before the release of a coroner's finding later this month. Alana Cecil was last seen at Melton Station at 4 p.m. on November 9, 1996. She was catching a bus to Deer Park to visit a friend. At 8 a.m. the following day, her body was discovered at a vacant house in Station Road, Melton. A post-mortem examination found the cause of death to be heroin toxicity in a young girl with acute asthma. No drug paraphernalia was found at the scene. There were unconfirmed sightings of Miss Cecil at the Jerawarra Bonfire Festival in Melton on the night of November 9th between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m. When she was found, her clothing was in disarray. The autopsy report confirmed two buttons on her jeans were not fastened, her underpants were inside out and back to front, and there was dirt near the bottom of her jeans. Medical evidence indicated Miss Cecil had sexual activity with two unidentified males prior to her death. Evidence presented in the coroner's court suggested it was possible this activity may have been non-consensual. Miss Cecil was not on birth control at the time, nor did she have a boyfriend. The court heard it was possible that she could have been having non-consensual sex at some other location, been injected and relocated. Miss Cecil's father said his daughter had been drug-free for 3 months leading up to her death. This was confirmed in the autopsy report. The autopsy also found two fresh puncture wounds inside Miss Cecil's left and right elbows. Mr. Cecil says this was not consistent with his daughter's history and that she had a well-known fear of injecting herself. Miss Cecil was last seen wearing a black lace-up cardigan, blue denim jeans and black slip-on shoes. A number of her belongings remain missing, including a small backpack with personal items, jewellery and a tight-fitting smooth bangle. The autopsy found a bruise over the dorsal aspect of her left hand. The coroner is expected to deliver a finding on October 15.
I, Jennifer Coate, State Coroner, having received an application to reopen the investigation into the death of Alana Cecil, age 16 years, make the following order. The findings not be set aside, as I am satisfied that, whilst there are new facts and circumstances, it is not appropriate to reopen the investigation, pursuant to Section 77-3 of the Coroner's Act 2008.
The family of a Melton teenager who died 6 years ago are for the first time appealing for further information about the girl's death before the release of a coroner's finding later this month.
But she was just so happy, so bubbly, smiling all the time. Like, she was just so much fun to be around. She was just beautiful.
If I could go back now knowing what I know now, they'd be dead. Yeah. I'd be in jail.
And she got stolen away from me. And those culprits who did it, I want to catch them. I want to get them. And they know who they are. And I won't ever give up.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt.
It is a beautiful blue sky, no cloud day in Melbourne, Australia. Sitting beside the Yarra River, it's just slowly meandering its way down through the city. And a beautiful city it is. I was asked in an interview recently, and the interviewer, Sean, asked me, how do you compartmentalize what you do? She said, obviously you must be able to do it. You can go home and switch off from, you know, the sort of horrible content that you deal with. My answer, frankly, was that I don't. And I can't. You know, I do take my work home with me. And I can't switch off, you know, whether it's sleepless nights or having a conversation with someone, but you're not really there. I'm somewhere else, buried in 300 plus pages of case files. But the one thing I do is exercise. When I feel that pressure getting high and I'm, you know, anxiety or whatever it might be, the best way for me to alleviate that was running. And that's what I'm doing this morning. Running along the river, I've just stopped to talk to you. Today I catch a plane back to New Zealand after I've been here for a few weeks, getting this investigation underway, and I've interviewed dozens of people, family, friends, and people that weren't friends, to try and get to the truth of what happened to Alana Cecil November 10th, 1996, when she was found dumped in a vacant property on the corner of Barry's Road in Melton, which is just outside of Melbourne. As you're going to find out, this case is not just a case of a simple heroin overdose. And it's time that the family got answers, the public got answers, her friends got the truth, and I've seen the real emotion in people's eyes when I've been speaking to people throughout this few weeks. But now I go home, I have to get married in a couple of weeks. I say I have to get married, I'm looking forward to getting married in a couple of weeks, putting together the first part of this podcast, and then I'll be back for the second part, and we can really start to rattle some cages. But this podcast is going to be one that's going to challenge you. It's going to make you very angry, sad, emotional. And it's going to test your character, your judgmental character. You know, and I'm going to ask you to put that aside. To remember what we're dealing with here, which is a girl who was only just 16 years old at the time of her death. And in the previous 2 years, you know, her drug troubles were largely down to older influences. And two of these men, their DNA was found on and inside Alana. And all the other circumstantial evidence points towards the fact that this was not consensual. But we'll get to all of that. We'll get to all of that, I promise you. For now, I hope you enjoy this story, Alana's story, and anyone out there that may have any information related to Alana's death, you know, now's the time to come forward, to do the right thing by her and her family. Right. Now, I finish my run, and then is go catch a plane. And the work begins in the office putting this together. And like I always say, let's get into it.
For those of you that have followed this podcast for some time, you'll know the level I go to investigate the cases I choose. Physically, I leave no stone unturned. Whether it's knocking on door after door, driving thousands of kilometers, or staying up all night chasing trains, I do what needs to be done. But beyond the physical aspect of this work, there is a very real emotional toll that needs to be paid. And personally, I invest everything. And after season 3 of Guilt, Finding Heidi, I was both physically and emotionally drained. I knew I needed to select a new case. And I knew I wanted that case to be my first international story set in Australia. I put out the call, but despite being sent hundreds of emails proposing cases, I was struggling to connect with one. Until one day in February, I received an email and everything changed.
So, as you know, I went to primary school with Alana.
Every story has its origin. And in the case of my investigation of Alana's death, that can be traced back to one person. Someone who knew Alana as a young girl.
She was in the grade below me, and so I started at that primary school in 1988 in grade 3. My family had moved from another suburb to Melton, and I started. So I knew Alana. She was, like I said, the grade under me. So I wasn't close friends to her, but I certainly knew her. You know, and I remember, she, you know, she was a gorgeous girl, beautiful blonde hair, slim, athletic and energetic, very confident, well-liked. And I recall I was living in Queensland at the time when I heard that she had died. And I remember hearing that she had died of a heroin overdose, but that her body was dumped. And so over the years, I've followed along her tribute page. And I knew that Alana's dad, Peter, was still looking for answers and looking for justice. And because of my background in law, I had a bit of an understanding of the legal challenges that Peter was facing in terms of the justice system. And over the last sort of few years, I've taken a real interest in podcasts, particularly true crime podcasts. And so I think it was about 12 months ago I said to a friend of mine, "Do I really feel the need to reach out to Peter Cecil and just make a suggestion that he consider a podcast for Alana's case?" Because I knew, you know, he was still looking for answers and he hadn't really got where he wanted to go in terms of the legal system. And so I just sat on that, and my friend said to me, "Oh, you know, that would be a great idea," and she thought I should do it. And it wasn't really until I listened to your previous podcast, Finding Heidi, at episode 11, where you made a call out to listeners for suggestions for season 4. And I rang my friend immediately and I said, "Oh my goodness, Ryan Wolf has just made a call out for suggestions for a case in Australia." And it ticked all the boxes, like unsolved, at least 10 years old, small town. And I just couldn't believe it. And I thought, "Oh my goodness, this is now. I need to do this." But I reached out to Peter and I put forward the suggestion of a podcast. And he replied straight away and said, you know, that he was really happy to share details of Alana's case with me and was really open to the suggestion of a podcast. So we arranged to meet and we met in late last year. And it was just apparent at that point that Peter would really do anything to get answers. In talking to him, he had already done his own investigations. He'd spoken to people. He'd gathered evidence. He'd kept meticulous notes. And talking to Peter, you know, he really has this fantastic recall memory. He can remember dates and times and who said what. And I was just really impressed, you know, with Peter. And also it just showed that, you know, his sheer determination and the love that he has for Alana. And I suppose, you know, as a parent myself now, it was really heartbreaking to me, for me, because I really just couldn't imagine the pain and anguish that, that Peter and Alana's family has been through, particularly knowing the way that Alana died. And so once we finished that meeting, my friend and I agreed that we would draft an email with the hope that we would send it out to an investigative journalist who, you know, might be interested in the case. And so we actually thought we'd miss the cutoff for your season four because we listened to that. And that was about September of last year. But what we did, you know, what we did want to do is still reach out to you in, just in case you were able to give us advice on how to go about, you know, getting Alana's case on a podcast. And so we decided to send that email to you. And I think that was in February of this year. And we were so surprised to get your response pretty much immediately and the, your advice that you were looking into the case. And really it just took off from there. So, you know, I just feel that sort of things just fell into place along the way, which has led us to where we are now, which is just wonderful.
I receive a huge number of suggestions or proposals for cases. But the email I received from Chantelle and her friend really was quite exceptional in its clarity. All the key points of the case were laid out concisely, and as a result of that great work, within only a few weeks, I picked up my family and we flew 3,000 kilometres to Melbourne, Australia, where I rented a car and found myself driving to Melton for the first time, where I'd be meeting with Alana's family.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
For me, this period of time just prior to starting a case always makes me the most nervous. What if the family don't like me? What if it turns out I've just gotten lucky so far and I actually suck as an investigator? Self-doubt can be crippling if you dwell in it, and I push these thoughts aside, remembering that as with every case, these thoughts vanish the moment that first interview begins. Melton often gets a bad rap from locals and Victorians, and even though today it is a city with a population of just under 200,000, many consider it just an outer suburb of Melbourne, just 15 minutes up the road, population 5 million. As I pull off the M8 motorway into Melton, my initial feeling is that it's not quite what I was expecting. It feels quiet. And while there are a few vacant properties and the odd pile of abandoned furniture, it certainly doesn't feel like I'm about to be mugged. But I can't help but notice that every window and every house in the city is completely shuttered up. It screams, "Stay out. My home, my business. Piss off." As I pull up to the address, a hot rod pulls out of the driveway. And Peter waves out.
Peter, how are you? Nice to see you. Did you just roll in that, did you?
I just said, I've got spies everywhere.
Well, that's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
How are you?
He's into these cars.
Yeah, okay.
When
he leaves New Zealand. Yeah, that's a hub. That's New Zealand. It's a
hub to me. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, went from New Zealand to America and then over to Australia. Yeah, but New Zealand's a hub.
Yeah, but terrific car. Who's your on the feet? We all get on, you probably know, it's pretty good. Family.
Yeah. Hey everyone, how are you?
Hello, how are you? You want to go inside or scared?
No, he's fine. I don't know, it's up the right.
I think he'll be okay, actually. Yeah. It's as long as there's not too much background noise, yeah.
Just a bird.
That's just Australia in general, isn't it? There's birds everywhere. Not one of those parrot birds. Oh, right.
The hot rod leaves. And we make our way through the carport, and it opens into a spacious, friendly space with a large backyard. Sitting at an outside table are two women, Cheryl, Alana's mother, and Peter's longtime partner, Christine. This was the Cecil family home back in 1996, and the home Alana and her brother Ricky grew up in. Today, Alana's mother, Cheryl, lives here with her partner. It strikes home that Alana, the girl I've now read and heard so much about, once roamed these halls. Peter and I grab a seat, and I begin setting up my equipment for the first time. Without any prompting, Peter launches into the case and the issues that have plagued it over the last 28 years. He's like a kettle boiling over, ready to explode. But for me, the first and most important thing I want to speak about is the reason I'm here today. I want to speak about Alana and who she was. The good times.
I'm Peter Cecil. I'm Alana's father, and I loved her very much. And we had Alana as a young girl, was like any normal girl growing up, and things changed. Well, she was interested in sport, and she was athletic, and she was fairly mature for her age, outside her age group. She did well at school. She was well loved by her teachers. Never had any problems at school. Her work was of a high standard. I was a teacher myself, and I've actually kept all her books and stuff. But just reviewing it, how she was going, her reports and stuff, she was. So she wasn't a, she was an intelligent girl, as she was growing up, she certainly had character as well. She gave a few laughs with her antics, and yeah, she could put on a little bit of a drama, but it was all in jest. There was nothing else. She's just a happy girl. I think by the time she actually moved to my school where I was teaching, moved from Melton South to Coburn Primary School in Melton, and again she did a grade six there. She wanted to be with her father, and I said yep, no problem, and she did very well at school. And yeah, but she socialised well with other girls, made friends fairly easy.
As you've probably already gathered, Peter was a teacher in Melton South. Throughout this case, it's going to be a consistent trend of witnesses I speak to, that they knew both Alana and respected her father, Mr. Cecil, the teacher.
Did she go into your class when she went?
No, she didn't go to my class. She went into a teacher called Trudy Williams, and Trudy was a good friend of mine anyway, because we taught together. And Trudy couldn't speak more highly of her. She's written little things along the way to me to say, Trudy adored her, not because she was my daughter, just because of who she was and her personality. she's pretty likeable girl. So,
yeah, everyone that I've sort of, you know, messages that I've got from people, and everyone says the same. No one said a bad thing about ever, like, bubbly personality, you know, just very nice. You know, is that how you describe it, sort of?
Yep, absolutely. She, yeah, she's, I don't think that all her friends, even to this day, you know, they say that how, you know, they really liked Alana. How, and, yeah, they miss her. They want something to be done about the case and the way she was found. And it's upset a lot of people, especially my friends, close friends and family, and her grandparents and that. But we need to, yeah. So we're, but that's an indication underlies, you know, the type of girl she was. Like, yeah, she's never ever hurt anybody. Yeah, she's in that time.
You've got two children, Ricky and
I've got So I've got Ricky's son, my son. He's excellent. He's grown up to be, you know, upstanding kid. Works insurance, lives on the Gold Coast. Got a wife. Given us two grandchildren, and he's very responsible. He's very invested in. What happens in this case. He loved his sister. They got on very well together. They were like, you know, peas in a pod, where Ricky was, Alana would be, whether it'd been in the sand pit or in the pool or thing. So, yeah, they had a good relationship.
What was the age difference between them?
1 year. Yeah. But Alana was born in 1980 and Ricky was born in 1979.
Okay, so he was the big brother.
He's the sort of big brother. Yeah. I think Alana thought he was she was the big sister.
Yeah, she certainly sounds like she was quite mature for her age. Yeah.
She was, and that was some sort of concern as she got older, you know, with maybe getting out of her depth with people, especially, you know, given that she wasn't, the maturity still stays the same. It's not as if, you know what I mean by that, the naivety still. Yeah, she might be more advanced in her age, but and her thinking, but she still wasn't aware of what could be out there, I guess.
Especially when you're hanging around with older, I see a lot of the names of older people, and, you know, probably not from good parts of society, I guess we would say.
That's correct. She tended to hang around with, because of the maturity, hang around with older adolescents and. And I think that got her into trouble down the track, no doubt. Yeah, we fought a hard battle. I fought a hard battle with her, and I watched her go through it, and I learned a lot about the drug scene, the people in it, the culture, even though I was a teacher, teaching health ed and all that sort of stuff. It woke me up I think Alana got caught up in that to this day I still think peer groups are a very important issue. It depends, it's a bit like a raffle, and if you draw the wrong ticket out, then unfortunately instead of winning you can have a big loss. And I think Alana, that's exactly what happened to Alana when she started high school. And she drew the wrong ticket and met a person that took her down the wrong road. And that's how it all started.
Yeah. And as a teacher from this area, what's the area like in terms of that wrong road? Is it a road a lot of kids take?
Yeah, at the particular time, with Alana growing up, and it was probably middle class to lower class type, socioeconomic type Melton. So there was basically divided into parts as well, like different parts, like most cities, big towns. So you'd have your lower Melton cells, probably the lower end of the scale, where I taught was probably the middle, and then you had the west up the top end, which is probably Toorak, you know, the best end. So the people, that's basically it, but infiltrating all that, and interweaving all that was there was a lot of there tend to be a growth in the drug industry, dealers and in this town, and unfortunately to this day there's still a lot of it, and it's in the news a lot. Melton's in the news. So, but in that particular time, it was really a growth area. By the time Alana, in Alana's case, it was pretty rife, and there was other contingencies involved as well. Don't know if I should mention, but we're talking about pedophilia and pedophile rings and corrupt police and stuff like that. And it wasn't Melton was a mixed bag, and that's what made it so difficult with this case, due to that.
Yeah. So when was Alana about 12 when she started high school? 13 or?
Alana was 12 when she started, and she started well, but then when she met the particular person, started to derail, and we found out that she was starting to not go to school. She started to upset herself, wag, so to speak, and that wasn't in the character of Alana. We were pretty trusting as parents, like most parents are, of your thing, because she's never given us any trouble. We least suspected that, again, the naivety, and even I as a teacher, even be aware a little bit about it, but of how influential a person could be, and the particular family that particular person had, which was pretty dysfunctional. And so you don't discover till it's too late, and we discovered too late before we could actually do anything, because one of the qualities of Alana was that she was very loyal to her friends. So, and that loyalty, she wouldn't see past that. So she'd call black, blue, or whatever you like to call it. And so if you questioned her friends, she would never give them up. She was such, it was a great trait, but I respected it, but it was it was a weakness in the end.
Yeah, especially from a parent's point of view.
It camouflaged what was happening.
Yeah. So around that time, that's sort of when, so she meets Jody, I guess, and then starts going off the rails a bit. Yeah.
Oh, she loved Jody. They were the best.
This is Cheryl, Alana's mum. Throughout this interview, she's remained reserved. And Peter later tells me that this is how she's dealt with the heartbreak. She finds it very difficult to speak about Alana's death. But when it comes to the subject of Alana going off the rails, Cheryl believes she knows how and why. Alana's best friend, Jody Hadley.
Yeah, because she used to go there, and Jody was allowed to do what she wanted, and the brother was out the back supplying them. That's when she got onto the marijuana. The brother used to give it to him because he was a lot older than Jody. Yeah, she used to come here and stay, but she'd walk in, she'd say hello, but she never looked at you. Her head would be down like this. She was very sneaky. But Lana liked her, so Lana used to go stay there, obviously, because they could do what they want, and then she would stay here, but they weren't on anything here. But, she was trouble. I don't trust her one bit.
But at the time when she initially met her, you didn't realise the scale of what was going on?
No. But her dad was a lot older, like heaps older than the mum, and that's why they had the oldest son who was... I don't know when they were 12. He was in his 20s when Alana was 13. That's where it all started. And of course, they loved going there because he used to supply him with it.
Yeah.
And then she met the cowards through, I don't know how she met them, probably through Jody, and that's why she was wagging them with the cowards and they were on it. Yeah.
Snowballs.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, Cheryl, and more so Peter, have had 28 years to analyse every detail of what went wrong and what could have been. And although they have softened over time, naturally, they still carry a feeling of resentment towards many of those they consider may have led Alana astray.
You know, did you ever have worries that things might be go too far or something bad might happen, or did you not sort of think that until...
Once I were on the drugs, once we knew they were on the drugs, I didn't sleep at night. I was waiting for a knock on the door. Because we had a lot of trouble controlling Alana, because behaviour goes out the door. It becomes erratic. She wanted to be with Jody, so she'd break out and, you know, climb out the windows. And so it's a pretty chaotic time for us as parents. And
sadly, it was at this time, aged only 14, that Alana and Jody were introduced to harder drugs, in particular, heroin. Today, this may sound difficult to fathom, but Melbourne in the 90s saw a flood of cheap, high-quality, pure heroin, and as the result was an epidemic of youth addiction and overdose. Over the following couple years, Alana would struggle with her addiction, but in the year before her death, had made a conscious decision to kick the drug. After a short stint in rehab in 1996, she returned home and got clean, with a positive mindset. Peter tells me that after 2 years of hell, they finally felt like they'd won the battle. They had Alana back. But that all changed the night of the bonfire, November 9th, 1996. I know it's going to hurt, but I ask them to take me back to that terrible night. The last night they saw their daughter alive.
Why don't you take me back? You know, we only have to go there once, but to that night of the bonfire festival, you know, and how, you know, how it unfolded. And so Alana left that day.
She said, "If I'm not coming home, Mum, I'll let you or Dad know." That was her words to me.
That's what she said to me.
"Oh, Mum, gave me a kiss goodbye and said, if I'm not coming home, I'll let you or Dad know."
She was here.
I got the knock on the door at 8 o'clock in the morning. The police standing there, I knew straight away. I just knew. And I knew the policeman, like knew his wife and that. Yeah, 8 o'clock. I saw him standing there, I said, I knew. Didn't think he was here for anything else. I just knew something bad.
We didn't know exactly what was going on until we got back here to Cheryl's place.
Yeah. I was on my own.
Yeah. And the policeman had rung Peter's phone and said, you need to come home. And then Peter put me onto the policeman. And I said, how bad is it? And he said, it's really bad. And I knew straight away. And I had to come all the way back from Geelong, knowing and not being able to tell her.
So it was just after that, it was just a blur. I really struggled, and everybody struggled. We was just in disbelief. My first thought was that Alana got back onto the heroin. Like I said before, they... Once you're on heroin, they can go back. But so I was sort of thinking that way. Until I read the autopsy report, looked at the toxicology report, and then looked at the state. As the case unfolded, I realised that there was more to it, and it didn't add up. And it's been proven right. So I knew from that point. Then but still doesn't bring my daughter back. I've got to be honest with you. All I was left with, and I haven't been able to get out of my head ever, is that I sat on the bunk at home, and next to me was a green lunchbox, small green lunchbox, and it had Alana's ashes in it, and that was my daughter I was left with. And I sat with that lunchbox. It was plastic green, light green, olive green colour, and I sat next to it, and I thought to myself, that's my daughter. Why? Questions. So a lot of people don't know with that. You know, I'm sharing something that I've never ever disclosed to anybody. But, so I live with that nightmare, that thing, and I want justice. I want to do the right thing by her and get her justice and get closure for everybody, and especially me, because I went through hell with her. And I loved her, and she got stolen away from me. And those culprits who did it, I want to catch them. I want to get them, and they know who they are, and I won't ever give up.
We've just taken the first small step in what is going to be a long and difficult road. As you're probably aware, if this was simply the case of a heroin overdose, I wouldn't be here. There is so much more to come. In the next episode, we're going to hear more about Alana from some of her friends, and we're going to start exploring some of the details of Alana's tragic case. Thank you so much for listening to this first episode. And remember, if you're a local resident of Melton or Melbourne, please share the word of this podcast and Alana's story. Because it's only with your help that we can finally get to the truth. We're going to finish every episode of this season with something special. We don't have audio of Alana's voice, but we do have her words. Her family have kindly shared letters and poems written by Alana, and these will be read at the end of every episode by Ricky's daughter, Alana's niece, Elena, who today is 14 years old.
August 15th, 1990. To Mel and everyone. Hi, how is everyone? I'm fine. I'm on holidays right now. I got your letter. You're not stupid. I read Nana's letter that you sent. She cried. Yes, I've seen Diane's baby. His name is David. He's very cute. He looks exactly the same as Michael. Rick is going to Melton High Secondary College. I don't know what I'm going to do, because we might be shifting to Queensland, so Dad says. Yes, I'm into music and stuff. My favourite songs are Hold On by Wilson Phillips, I Remember You by Skid Row, and Spin That Wheel. I've got heaps more. We haven't had our inter-school sports yet. Ricky is captain again. I went to see The Little Mermaid. I'm going to see Dick Tracy and the Wizards. In the holidays, me, Mum, Ricky went to Nana's. I got new shoes, jeans, jacket, coat, t-shirts and jumper. I go to the discos with Megan, Hayley and other girls. Sometimes we dance in a group with the boys. Is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles a big thing up there? It is down here. My hands are going to drop off soon, so I better go. Love from your cousin, Alana.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that. Opinions. And are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. You'll find further photos, videos and daily updates on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ. The fantastic original score was produced specifically for this season of Guilt by Sam Morgan at sunroomsound.com. If you're looking for original music for your project, check out his great work. Voice acting in this episode, Tegan Lawson as the newsreader, Jake Hawkins as Sergeant Dennis Boyer, Dean Young as Coroner Michael Burke, and Donna Lee Perfect as Jennifer Cote. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding. You can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details on how to subscribe at theguiltpodcast.com. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.